Today's episode deals with mature themes. Listener discretion is advised. Holy sweet mercy, someone does not want us recording today.
Seriously, we started after 20 minutes of troubleshooting my mic, and then Caroline's internet and video went out, and then it was a whole thing, and yeah.
My internet literally just went just like that. Like, it was done with our nonsense, trying to figure things out, and it had enough, and it wanted out.
To hear that our last week's episode was just that bad that now our computers are haunted and we're just screwed.
Well, I blame you for that, not me.
Yeah, that's my fault. My bad.
Man. Did you keep the recording that you had before this, or did you delete it already?
No, I deleted it.
I was going to keep it.
Because we had attempted to record about 2 minutes and then it went out. And then I stopped it and Caroline's like, keep recording! And I was like, too late!
I'm going to keep it and I'm going to cut together like a blooper episode because I was just talking the whole time. I was like, oh, Haley left. Let's hope she's okay.
Because you introduced the podcast and sometimes like the audio does cut out, mm-hmm. especially like if you ever just kind of see me nodding and you've asked me a question, I'm just pretending that like you've continued on with your story so that I don't mm-hmm. mess up the audio by going, wait, can you repeat that? I didn't hear that.
Mm-hmm. I'm literally doing that right now because you just cut out a little bit.
Yeah, but I just assumed it cut out and I wasn't sure if you had introduced yourself because I didn't want to go, and I'm Haley, and you're in the middle of talking, you know?
I was wondering why the pause took so long. Oh, sweet, 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 sweet night. Sweet, sweet mother moon. This is It's Hereditary, and I'm Caroline, and I'm a little stressed at this point. And Haley just cut out again.
No, you guys. Caroline's internet cut out again. Oh, no.
Oh, I'm telling you, mercy,
someone's computer
internet.
Is haunted. Oh, my God.
Holy. Holy Lord.
I didn't stop recording
cannot.
That time.
I feel like I'm playing whack-a-mole or Frogger with this internet. Nobody jinx it. Thank goodness we're not doing hauntings this episode. Oh my gosh.
Jesus.
Why is this happening? We just want to bring some dark entertainment to the masses, and it's making it so difficult. Oh, jeez. Did you introduce yourself? Because you cut out.
I did, yes.
Okay. Oh, cheers. Mm-hmm. So aside from all of this, how are you feeling? How's life?
Life is fine. I'm a week into the school year. Haven't lost my mind yet, so.
That's good. Do you want to know how I'm feeling?
Go ahead.
Betrayed. I'm feeling betrayed. By my internet, by you, and by Cassie. I'm feeling betrayed by all three things.
Yeah, she called me today and I was like, yeah, she's mad at you.
Yeah, let her know. Cassie, I'm mad at you. Cassie sent us an email. That now I'm not even, Haley's going to read it because Cassie's like, here's the murder that happened where I'm from. And I caught the email before Haley had time to read it and put it in a folder where I couldn't find it. So I was like, this is great. Thanks. I'm going to hide it away and I'm going to keep it from Haley and it's going to be a surprise. And then Cassie told her that evening. So thank you, Cassie. I feel betrayed. And I feel betrayed by you, Haley. Because you broke the oath last week, and I'm still not over it. And as I was editing the recording, I still was not over it. Because you only have to listen once. I have to listen multiple times to try to make us sound coherent.
Yeah.
I feel better getting that out of my system.
Well, I feel like all this computer nonsense is karma for all of that, because I'm sure some demonic entity has now possessed my computer.
Ugh. Well, apparently
or your computer too. Or something.
It's my internet. I don't know what the deal is. There are too many things.
Your internet, my microphone, it's just a mess. I apologize to everybody for the terrible feedback on my mic last week.
It wasn't that
bad. I had to just completely unplug it, and I'm using the regular microphone on my computer, because that's what I've got for now.
It really wasn't that bad. I started not being able to hear it whenever I was editing, so don't lose sleep. We're professionals, we promise. No, just kidding, we're not.
No, not at all.
Sorry, my sinuses are really bad, but...
My mom likes to remind me that, like, she listens... religiously, like a supportive mother, but she likes to remind me, she's like, yeah, you guys definitely do sound like millennials. I'm like, yeah, okay, thanks.
Well, I mean, what does she want us to sound like? Whose fault is that, really? Is it our fault that we grew up in this generation, or their fault that they had us and raised us in this generation? I don't think it's our fault.
I'd rather be a millennial than Gen Z, though. So, the Tide Pod eating crazies.
I mean, every generation has something. Remember the, ours was the choking. Do you remember that? Where you would like choke people out and see how long they would go. And that was the stupid thing that our, it's yeah. always going to be something. So I can't even really fault them for that. It's not good. Don't do it. But every generation's got something.
Yeah.
Okay. I can't remember. We did introduce the podcast on this recording, right?
We did. Yes.
And we introduced ourselves. Okay.
Correct.
So we're doing, bless up, true crime today. Because I can't handle any more entities around this.
Got another couple of weeks until we get back to the hauntings.
Yes, 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 yes. And yeah, we're doing kidnappings and it's going to be awesome. I mean, awesome may not be the right word. Mine is actually kind of awesome. I do want to, though, up top, really quick, throw a trigger warning. I don't know about your story, but my story deals with crimes against a child, sexual assault, rape. So if that's a trigger for anyone, I will give another warning before I start talking about it. Maybe go listen to one of our other episodes. That being said, at least I don't know about Haley's story, but my story is incredible. So if you can get through it, it's amazing. And like, I just think everyone needs to hear it. And I can't believe it's not bigger news, but... yes, so trigger warning up top. We're talking about some really serious topics that we want you guys to be aware of. So, do I go first this week, or do you want to go first? Because mine actually has kind of a happy ending. Does yours have kind of a happy ending?
No.
Do you want to go first then? Because mine's gonna, like, I'm typing mine, and I'm like, I'm amped up.
I mean, we can end with yours if you want to end on a happy note. Mine's not. It was just a really, it's important. It's probably one of the more famous kidnappings in the United States, so I wanted to make sure it was covered.
Okay, well,
but
then I'll do it.
It's not happy.
Okay, well, I was going to say, if yours is, like, important, I think that's okay to end with. If, like, no one knew about yours and it was just sad, I was going to be like, maybe let me go second. But,
yeah, so you
no,
can
I'll
go
first. Okay. So, up top, sources, big, bold letters. I used Listverse, an interview done by ABC News, and the Lewiston Daily Sun. So, take a moment and picture this. You're about to go on a long trip with your family. I know you've been on a lot, I've been on a lot. And right before you leave, you and your mom decide you want to go get your hair did before y'all leave so you're all nice and fresh. So, the two of you go to the salon, you get the fresh cut and color, you're excited about your trip, you can't stop talking about it as you leave to get in your car and go finish packing, and then someone approaches you. They're looking at you like they know you, so you know you have that weird panicked moment where you're like, I need to figure out who this person is because they're approaching me with intent, like, oh, they must know me or they must want to ask me something. I need to be ready at the risk of, you know, feeling stupid and, you know, not knowing who they are and feeling rude because, God forbid, we come across as rude. So you rack your brain, but you can't remember. And then the man is upon you now with a gun out, pointing at you and says, I need a ride. So I start with a little storytelling because this story is real. And when I first heard it, it just seemed like a Hollywood blockbuster fiction thriller novel, and I could not believe it. And obviously, since this is our true crime episode, the story is true. So today I'm going to tell you the incredible story of the kidnapping of Mary and Beth Stauffer. Have you ever heard of this?
Nope.
Okay.
Tell me.
So I first heard of this story on Case File. Do you listen to Case File?
No, I do not.
Okay. If you're a true crime buff, like true crime buff, you live and breathe it, you have to listen, or you probably already listened to Case File. They have an anonymous host, which someone figured out who his identity is, but I just want to know who he is. But the way he tells stories a lot of times, he completely buries the lead. So he starts with one thing on this story, and then it turns into this other thing, and I'm listening, and I'm like, this is the most insane thing I've ever heard. And I just had to do more research on it. So, Case File is where I heard it first. I haven't listened to it in probably a year or two, so I didn't take anything from it, but that's where I first heard this story. Here we go. It's 1980. Mary and Irv Stauffer lived in Minneapolis, Minnesota with their two children, Beth and Steve. Mary was a former high school math teacher, and she and her husband were both Baptist missionaries. So as such, in May of 1980, the Stauffer family was preparing to move to the Philippines for a four-year stint to participate in missionary work there. They were this classic happy family, and they were all really looking forward to the big move. So it's the four of them, they're missionaries, they're embarking on this new adventure together. I mean, you can understand, like, you know, the buzz and the excitement, you know, before this. But little did they know that they, specifically Mary, were being watched, and that they were being stalked, and they were being hunted. Ming Sen Shui was born in Taiwan and immigrated to Minnesota with his family when he was a child. He attended Alexander Ramsey High School in Roseville, Minnesota, and was a good athlete and a good student, albeit a bit of a loner. In high school, he developed a crush on his ninth grade algebra teacher, Mary Stauffer, and this crush would bloom and blossom into a deadly obsession. So not only are we talking about kidnapping, we're talking about stalking.
Of a teacher, thank you for that.
Oh, I did not even think about that. I'm sorry. Because this is going to get cray. I think stalking is one of the scariest things because there's so little I feel like people can do about it, and then nothing can really get done until something serious
until something happens. Yeah,
you know, it's so terrifying. That stalker TV show that came out a couple years ago, couldn't even watch it. I think Maggie Q was in it.
I don't know, but that's part of why you creeps me out so much.
This is actually, so I did research on it after watching you. You creeped me out a lot.
The book was worse than the show.
I don't think I could read it. I don't think I could sleep.
Because he doesn't use her name. He puts, like, he says, you said this, you did that. So it puts the reader in her shoes, mm-hmm. and it chills down your spine. Like, it's, yeah.
Yeah.
No, thanks.
I'm so not about that. It's terrifying. Okay.
I'm just glad I'm not an interesting enough person for somebody to stalk, so.
Well, I don't know. You did have that fake Insta profile a while back.
Yeah. Yeah.
I totally get that you were, like, super upset about that, but
that's also, my students not having boundaries. Former students not having boundaries.
Boundaries are important, students. They're there for a reason. So this deadly obsession that Ming had with his teacher just stewed and seethed for 15 years. Throughout this time, Ming attempted to track down and stalk Mary throughout the 1970s. So this is, like, long gone. Like, he is out of high school, out of college, and he's still obsessed with her. In an interview, Mary recounts that Ming knew that Beth had one of those makeup Barbie heads that, you know, we all had.
Mm-hmm.
The head, and you did the hair and stuff. That she had those on her dresser in her room. He knew her son's name was Steve. And he knew that her parents had been in town recently. He even knew where the spare key to her apartment was. That's how hardcore he was stalking her. So it's obviously no surprise that he knew where she was going on the afternoon of May 16th, 1980. On that day, Mary and her 8-year-old daughter, Beth, went to a beauty salon in Roseville. As they were leaving, Ming approached them, and although he was simply still a stranger to Mary at the time, he shoved a gun to Beth's side and then told Mary that he needed a ride. He had Mary drive to a remote wooded area where he made her stop and then made them get out of the car. He bound Mary and Beth and then stuffed them into the trunk, which is, you know, it wasn't like a SUV trunk. It was like a little trunk. Ming then got behind the wheel of the car and continued driving. So they're abducted. Mary and Beth lay on the floor of the trunk praying. Ming told them to be quiet, but the two continued to pray. And during this time, Mary had also begun to loosen the bonds around Beth's hands. So deciding they were getting too loud, Ming stopped the car and came around the back and opened the trunk. He wrapped duct tape around their mouths, gagging them and quieting them. Upon seeing Beth's bonds were loosened, Ming also began to threaten them. So this whole thing's going on. This guy pulls over. He's obviously talking to the trunk. Whether or not you can see what's in the trunk, there's a guy talking to the trunk. So he's making a scene is what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not very subtle. So he's kind of causing a ruckus. And unfortunately, children are curious. So as Ming was dealing with Mary and Beth, two boys approached the car. One stayed at the front, while the other, 6-year-old Jason Wilkman, checked out what was going on in the trunk. Jason sees what's happening there and doesn't even have time to, like, react. All he says is, whoa. And then Ming grabs him and throws him in the trunk with Mary and Beth. So at this point, he has now kidnapped three people. And it's not like, the crazy thing is, it's not like this guy really had any history of, you know, breaking the law or violence or anything like that. Like, this is goes 0 to 100 real fast.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, the two being Mary and Beth didn't really know what were going on. And I guess the way they were placed, they couldn't see that he had thrown another being into the car. All Mary knew is she could hear whimpering and feel something moving. And then she could kind of feel how small it was. So she's like, oh my gosh, this is another, like, this is a child in the car with us. So then Mary just starts kind of talking to him. I guess like the gags had gotten ripped off or whatever in the ruckus. And he's just trying to keep, she's trying to keep him calm. So he told her that the next day he had plans to go visit with his grandparents. And so then the car stops. Jason was removed and all went dark again for Mary and Beth. And trigger warning for people, just FYI. The two would later learn that Ming beat Jason to death with a metal rod and left him in a wildlife refuge before taking the Stauffers to his house.
He was 6 years old.
He was six. But because he had found him out and...
Oh my God.
I know. I know. So that's actually how the case file episode starts. It's about Jason Wilkman's murder.
Yeah.
But then all this crazy stuff is happening too. I know.
It gets worse. That's like first grade.
I know. I know. He's six. Not exactly a threat. So at this point, police had received several calls about a 6-year-old boy named Jason Wilkman seen being abducted by a dark-haired man. So the police are out looking for Jason, but authorities and the rest of the Stauffers still had no idea that Mary and Beth were missing. So they're searching for Jason because they got calls, but still, because, you know, you're out and about with your mom. Dad's like, okay, they'll call me whenever they will. It's fine. They're together. Surely they're okay. Still no one knows that they're missing.
And not the time, you know, with cell phones or anything, really.
Exactly. That's exactly right. There was more trust, I guess. I always think about that, too. Like, I appreciate it, but my parents are like, call me whenever you get there. It's like, but what did your parents think? Like, you couldn't do that when you were younger.
They grew up in a time when hitchhiking was normal. Like,
exactly.
It took killers like Bundy and Son of Sam and Gacy and whoever the hell else was active around that time that Dahmer in the 80s, I guess, all of that to get people to go, okay, well, maybe we should think about what we do before we do it.
Sure. Let's lock a door.
Because there are crazy people out there. Yes. Lock doors, please. Please.
As night fell, with still no word from Mary or Beth, Mary's husband Irv called the police. Just 6 miles away. So Irv is calling the police. And then 6 miles away, while he's doing that, from their house, Beth and Mary were being led into a small house. They were blindfolded, shackled, and chained together, and Ming forced them into a tiny closet. Once inside, they managed to remove their blindfolds, and as they looked around, Mary discovered that this abduction had been planned. That the 21-inch by 4-foot closet, with a rug on the floor and pillows and the doorknob removed from the inside, had been prepared for them. And it wasn't long before the nightmare truly began. The afternoon they were taken, Ming ordered Mary out of the closet. He blindfolded her, brought her into the living room, and made her lie down. After tying her hands above her head to a piece of furniture, he began what seemed to Mary like an interview process. Oh, what an awful interview it was. He told Mary his name, and he was annoyed that like she didn't recognize him, which I think is awesome. And that he had tried to kidnap her multiple times. He said that once he used a blowtorch to try to break into her house, and in another instance, he tried to cut a hole in the floor under her bed.
Okay. That's like cartoonish. Like, you use the saw to cut around the thing, and the whole thing falls through the floor.
Yeah. And, like, whether or not this is true, I mean, we don't really know. He's a sociopath, but, I mean, still, like, imagine being, like, tied up. I'm not laughing. Imagine being tied up and... someone's monologuing to you, basically.
Evil villain monologue.
Yeah. He then brought up Mary's past as a math teacher, and he was annoyed that she didn't recognize him. He revealed that he'd been a student of hers 15 years ago, so he's 29 at this time, and that he'd developed a crush on her that obviously turned deeply sinister. He said that the grade she'd given him in her class was the only blemish on his otherwise perfect record, and that she cost him a scholarship, and that he was forced to go to Vietnam and suffer as a POW, which is all a lie. Like, none of this was true.
And yet he's still in love with her, and she, like, gave him a bad grade or whatever the deal was.
I know. So Pat Brown, a prominent criminal profiler, as you and I sometimes wish that we also were.
Yes. Every time I watch Criminal Minds, I'm like, I could do that? No, not at all.
Every time, yeah. No, I would have nightmares. I wouldn't sleep ever. Said that it's common for sociopaths to lie about their past, and that perhaps Ming was doing this so that he would feel justified in what he was doing to her. Because in reality, as I mentioned, Ming was a gifted student and athlete, and he was even voted most likely to succeed. So he had nothing to whine about. He was just making an excuse to make himself feel better about what he was doing to her.
Mm-hmm.
In the years between having Mary as a teacher and abducting her, Ming developed a list of his favorite actresses, and with this list, he wrote fantasies where he raped them and then they would beg him for sexual favors. Mary Stauffer was also on this list.
Jesus.
With Mary bound and vulnerable in his living room, Ming's fantasy was slowly being played out in horrific color. And, like we said, as all evil villains do, Ming began monologuing. He revealed to Mary that he had a three-step plan. Part one was to find Mary, part two was to get revenge on her, and part three, all he says is, quote, well, that depends on you. So, now I am going to give a trigger warning. If you get triggered easily, come back in about 15 seconds. So when Mary asked what he planned on doing to get revenge, he pulled a shirt over her face and began removing her clothing. Then he says, quote, I think you can guess. Mary was repeatedly raped throughout her ordeal, and later she would learn that Ming was videotaping her assaults, including this first one. The sexual attacks escalated over time, though Mary, in true Mama Bear fashion, managed to keep all of this from her daughter. And the attacks were focused on Mary. They weren't focused on Beth. So Beth was not assaulted. She was just kidnapped.
Wrong place, wrong time.
Right. And I'm not saying just kidnapped. Beth was kidnapped right. And went through her own ordeal. But Mary was the kind of product of his...
That was his fixation.
Yes, the fixation on his sexual attacks. So Mary says, quote, I had to turn my emotions off because it was too hard to think about, end quote. So if it makes anyone feel better, we have quotes from her. Obviously, they make it out, you know, just a little something to get you through the rest of the story. They do make it out. So by the time Mary and Beth were missing for 48 hours, the search had swelled to 300 officers and volunteers, but still nothing had been found. As the attacks continued daily, Ming told Mary that she needed to show him more affection. Can you believe this? Like, can you actually believe this piece of garbage?
He's delusional. I mean, you already knew that.
Like, I do love this part, though. Mary, in what I think is an immense show of strength, tells him, quote, I'm sorry, I cannot do that. I love my husband, and I've promised to be true to him until death. And what you ask, I cannot do, end quote. So when he tells her, you need to be more affectionate, that's what she tells him. The most eloquent screw you I've ever heard. I just think the story is incredible because her grace is insanely amazing. So upon that refusal, Ming threatened to kill Beth by suffocating her with a plastic bag if Mary didn't do what he said. He took a big plastic bag and put it over Beth's head as she sat in the closet, tucking it underneath her. So like a garbage bag, like put it all the way over her. He told Mary that if she was stupid enough to let her daughter die, he'd kill her son and husband too. And it's not difficult to see why Mary believed him. So then she gave him a peck on the cheek, and he told her that wasn't enough. So then she kissed him on the lips, and that seemed enough to suffice him because he took the bag off of Beth's head. Throughout their captivity, Beth and Mary were fed twice a day. On day 10, Ming allowed them to take a shower. And then it was on day 10 that he really kind of began to loosen his restraint on them. Mary said they would talk about ordinary topics, and Ming, who owned and was running an electronics store at the time, returned to his daily routine. On day 23, Ming took Mary and Beth on this bizarre road trip to a job fair in Chicago. The two were again restrained with cables and locks. Ming bought paper, crayons, and board games for Beth. And they were taking some kind of, like, RV, like a camper. So he puts them in a camper. Like, can you imagine that? He's not telling them where they're going. He just throws them in a camper and off they go. And then, if that weren't bad enough, in the evenings, he'd act out this, like, twisted family fantasy where he would play board games with Beth while Mary cooked dinner. So, like, he was... It's just disgusting. It truly is. So meanwhile, with no new clues or leads, the hunt for the two missing Stauffers had hit a dead end. And it really kind of continued in earnest because I read somewhere that Ming let Mary send two letters to Irv while she was being held captive. So they knew she was alive. They just didn't know where she was. On day 53, Ming told Mary he planned to buy a new camper for the three to live in. And it was then that she realized he never planned on letting them go. With a camper, they could move around, and it would be nearly impossible for the police to find and rescue them.
Yeah.
So Mary prayed and prayed to find a way to escape, and then an opportunity emerged. On July 7th, Mary realized that the chain that held her and Beth captive in the closet went over the door hinge, and the hinge pin could be lifted out like it had been greased. So it's like he took the hinge out, put the chain, and, like, put the door back, kind of. So she took the hinge pin out, and then the top of the door fell in on them, so they had, like, a little bit room to escape. She managed to quickly get out and get to a phone where she dialed the sheriff's office, and once the lady picked up, this is, quote, what Mary says. "This is Mary Stauffer, the Arden Hills kidnap victim, and I'd like someone to come and get us," end quote.
Succinct, to the point.
Like, I would love someone to come pick me up, please.
Please.
Like,
waiting.
Like, can you imagine? With all that adrenaline, like, you figured out how to escape, you get out, you talk to someone else, like, you've only been seen two other people for months, and she had, like, the sense of mind to be cool, calm, and collected and be like, yes, this is me, here I am, please come get me. She's amazing. So then Mary and Beth walked out of the house, which had been their prison, and waited in the front yard behind a tree. Like, I'd be, I don't know.
Down the street, around the corner, somewhere far from the house, just in case he comes back.
Right, but really, it's smart, because, you know, then they know where he is, they know where he lives, they don't have to search anymore for them. Like, really, I think it's smart. It's just also very brave and scary.
So many things could have gone wrong.
So many things. When the two officers arrived, Mary and Beth were still chained together with cables and bicycle chains around their waist. Ming had been at work while all of this was going down, and the officers arrested him at his office. All told, Mary and Beth were held captive for 2 months. But the ordeal would not end here.
Uh-oh.
Now it was time to go to trial. So if you think the story is crazy there, just you wait. It's insane. When the officers picked Ming up, they questioned him about both the Stauffer abduction and Jason Wilkman's murder. Ming insisted that he had left the six-year-old alive. In exchange for a lesser murder charge, he told the authorities where he let Jason run away, and officers soon found the boy's body. They also found that he'd been struck in the head with a blunt object, so obviously murder. Ming was charged with the kidnapping of Mary and Beth Stauffer and the murder of Jason Wilkman. He faced two trials. At the first of the two trials, this was the one for the kidnapping, Mary went to court to face her abductor and abuser. Like, she showed up. Federal prosecutor Tom Berg recounts what happened when Mary took the stand. He says, quote, "I turned around and here Ming had gotten out of his chair at the defense table and right in front of the jury was coming up to get at Mrs. Stauffer," end quote.
Absolutely not.
He got up and rushed her. Now, Berg, the prosecutor, thankfully, acting fast, managed to grab Ming and block his path to Mary. But unfortunately, Mary wouldn't get through the trials unscathed, because the poor woman has not been through enough.
Right.
So Ming's second trial was for Jason's murder, and he was enraged by the time this one rolled around. So again, criminal profiler Brown says that Ming was angered that Mary had the indecency to escape from him and that she ruined his fantasies and got him caught. Like, OMG. Talk about a temper tantrum. Like, this guy is just disgusting.
He's gross.
Ugh. Okay. As she testified, Once again, Ming lunged for Mary. So I don't know why they weren't restraining this guy at this point.
Seriously, where's the freaking bailiff?
I don't know.
Like, he should have been, like, on top of this dude.
Okay. Are you ready for this? Unfortunately, now there was no one there to stop him quickly enough, and this time he brought a weapon. So somehow, Ming had managed to smuggle a knife into the courtroom. He brought a knife.
Where'd he get said knife? Wasn't he in jail at that point? Or was he out on bail?
No, I think he was in jail at this point. I don't know. But Mary recounts that the knife must have been very sharp because she didn't initially feel anything. When it was all said and done, Ming managed to slice Mary's face from the center of her chin up the side of her mouth and out through her cheek. She would need 62 stitches. Can you believe that?
Like, stayed outside or, like, full Joker split?
No. Like, stayed outside.
Her face.
Like, stayed outside. God. Like, they got to him eventually and subdued him. I mean, it all had to have happened within, you know, 2 or 3 seconds.
Right.
But 62 stitches.
Shit.
Ming was convicted of Jason Wilkman's murder and sentenced to 40 years in prison with an additional 30 years for kidnapping. He's currently incarcerated in Minnesota, where now he's up for parole every 2 years. And I looked it up to see just kind of where he was at with the parole hearings. And it's literally like every 2 years, starting in like 2010, maybe, it's an article about him. And it's like parole denied, parole denied, parole obviously denied. So he's not getting out.
Good.
Now, I'd like to end my story not with the scumbag, but with what I think really shows Mary's strength. She was someone who protected her daughter and went through these horrible things and faced him in trial. And this guy, like, just could have really ruined her life. But, I mean, there are interviews with her now, and it's just, you would never think.
Mm-hmm.
So Mary gave an interview after, I believe it was one of these hearings. I don't think it was the trial. I think it was after one of the parole hearings. Maybe it was the trial. But she said she was deeply grateful to have the opportunity to meet some of Jason Wilkman's family members. She also said she was grateful to meet Ming's family. So she was glad to meet, like, his mom and stuff and just say, like, you know, it's not all bad.
What
you know?
Do you do as either a parent or I feel like if it's if the killer or kidnapper or whatever themselves is a parent, if you're the child, like, the family members, like, what do you even say to people?
Everyone's a victim, you know? And they were, it was just, it's incredible. And of course, Lifetime is making a movie about this out in October, and it's going to star Allison Hannigan.
Sweet.
So we'll have to watch it.
I love her.
And that is the incredible true story of the kidnapping of Mary and Beth Stauffer.
That's awesome.
Isn't that insane?
I mean, not awesome, tragic, but glad they made it out and, you know.
She is awesome. It's awesome that the way she survived this. It's incredible. Like, it's just when you think it's one thing, it's just another and another and another and another, and it's just, oh, it's crazy.
Yeah.
Whew. I'm typing this, and I'm like, I'm going to have to watch, because I'm going to want to, like, walk around and just be like, can you believe what she said? I'm so amped up.
And now you get to sit back and drink and listen to me talk.
What are you drinking today?
I'm still working on that blueberry wine.
My roommate and I both have Zinfandels open. So I was like, hey, you should try mine. She's like, you should try mine. So we did a little switcheroo tonight. She's drinking some of mine and I'm drinking some of hers. So thanks, girl. Thanks, O.
Nice. All right. Well, I guess I'll go ahead and go.
Like
my sources. Wikipedia, FBI.gov, Britannica.com, CrimeMuseum.org, PBS.org, The Independent, and Rutgers Today.
All right.
So, Caroline said our topic was kidnappings for this week, so I decided to, you know, go big or go home.
Oh, jeez.
Now, not to stray from what's become my norm, I'm going to bring in the TV movie references.
Can I guess what you're going to do really quick?
No, after I give you the shows and the movies that have inspired it, I'll let you guess.
Okay, cool.
So, reading this story, I immediately realized that it had inspired one of the many stories in the murder house in the very first season of American Horror Story. The tale of what happened to fictional Charles and Nora Montgomery and their son Thaddeus paralleled the story in more than one aspect. This case also inspired Agatha Christie's Murder on the Orient Express in 1934. Hmm. Christie described the kidnapping of baby girl Daisy Armstrong in her novel and later the movie adaptation in 2017, and subsequent murder of the kidnapper aboard the train by people with connections to the Armstrong family.
Spoiler!
So, do you want to go ahead and guess who
I'm Yes, and
I'm
think
doing?
I'm right. I'll take a Lindbergh baby for $300.
You are correct.
I don't know the story, though, so I'm excited.
So, Charles Augustus Lindbergh was an American aviator who made the first solo nonstop flight across the Atlantic on May 20th, 1927. He was famous in his own right for his own accomplishments. However, 5 years after his flight, his name appeared in newspapers across the country for an entirely different and completely horrific reason. Charles and his wife, Anne, welcomed a baby boy into their family on June 22, 1930. Little blonde-haired, blue-eyed Charles Lindbergh Jr. was cared for by his parents and nurse until March 1, 1932, when he was just months shy of turning two. Mm. At 7:30 p.m. on March 1, 1932, Lindbergh family nurse Betty Gow put 20-month-old Charlie into his crib in the second-floor nursery. Around 9:30 p.m., Colonel Lindbergh was in the library just below the baby's room when he heard a noise that he imagined to be slats breaking off a full crate in the kitchen.
Hmm.
At 10 p.m., Gow discovered that the child was missing from the crib.
Really?
The nurse also...
That sound that he said he thought it was is very specific.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, repeat that part before that.
At 10 p.m., Gow discovered that the child was missing from the crib. The nurse also found that the baby was not with his mother, who had just come out of the bathtub. She then alerted Colonel Lindbergh, who immediately went to the baby's room, where he found a ransom note in an envelope on the windowsill. The note contained bad grammar and handwriting, so roughly it read, "Dear sir, have $50,000 ready, $25,000 in $20 bills, $15,000 in $10 bills, and $10,000 in $5 bills. After 2 to 4 days, we will inform you where to deliver the money. We warn you for making anything public or notifying the police. The child is in," he wrote, "gut care." I don't know what he was supposed to mean with that. A lot of this is just like me tweaking the words to what he should have meant.
Mm-hmm.
Indication for all letters are, and he had this weird signature at the bottom of his letter. It was a
zodiac.
No.
Oh.
It was two interconnected blue circles surrounding a red circle with a hole punched through the red circle and then two more holes to the left and the right. It was like a rings almost. It was weird.
Okay, can we get a picture of that for our Instagram for people that don't have a vivid imagination like me?
Oh, I'm gonna put the letter.
Beautiful.
I have a picture of the letter. Lindbergh took a gun and went around the house and grounds with butler Ollie Whateley. They found impressions in the ground under the window of the child's room and pieces of a cleverly designed wooden ladder. They also found a baby's blanket.
Mm-hmm.
The butler telephoned the Hopewell Police Department to inform them of the missing child. Colonel Lindbergh then contacted his attorney and friend, Henry Breckenridge, in the New Jersey State Police. I can't talk today.
It's okay. We had a stressful start to the episode, and it's a stressful topic.
Hopewell Borough Police and New Jersey State Police officers conducted an extensive search of the home and its surrounding area. After midnight, a fingerprint expert examined the ransom note and ladder. No usable fingerprints or footprints were found, leading him to conclude that the kidnapper wore gloves and had some type of cloth on the soles of his shoes.
Huh. All right.
To kind of keep there from being like treads of any kind.
Something.
No adult fingerprints were found in the baby's room, including in areas witnesses admitted to touching, such as the window, but the baby's fingerprints were found.
Whoa. And he's like almost two, right? So he's barely walking.
Right.
Huh. Right.
But like even Charles's fingerprints, none of them, and they admitted to being over at that window.
That's very bizarre.
No fingerprints were found. During the search of the kidnapping scene, traces of mud were found on the floor of the nursery. Footprints, impossible to measure, were found under the nursery window. Two sections of the ladder had been used in reaching the window. One of the two sections was split or broken where it joined the other, mm-hmm. indicating that the ladder had broken either during the ascent or descent. There were no bloodstains in or about the nursery, nor were there any fingerprints.
Okay.
Word of the kidnapping spread quickly. Military friends of the Lindberghs got involved in the investigation, which kind of allowed Lindbergh to take control of the investigation's direction, and the speculation started. So Colonel Lindbergh and his men believed that the mob were involved, so they contacted somebody who was rumored to know mobsters, and that guy turned to two speakeasy owners for help. Yeah, I don't know. Lindbergh appointed them as intermediaries, basically, to deal with the mob.
This is such, like, a vintage crime thing, where it's like, the mobsters turned to the speakeasy owners, and they did this.
Just wait.
Oh, okay.
Several organized crime figures, notably Al Capone, Willie Moretti, Joe Adonis, and Abner's Willman, spoke from prison, offering to help return the baby in exchange for money or for legal favors. Oh, specifically, Capone offered assistance in return for being released from prison under the pretense that his assistance would be more effective. Jeez. And that was quickly denied by the authorities.
He's like, thanks, but no thanks.
How about no? Considering what they got him on, like, tax evasion or something, didn't they? Like, it took them...
It was tax evasion.
Yeah. So, the morning after the kidnapping, authorities notified President Herbert Hoover of the crime. At that time, kidnapping was classified as a state crime. The case did not seem to have any grounds for federal involvement.
Huh.
Attorney General William D. Mitchell met with Hoover and announced that the whole machinery of the Department of Justice would be set in motion to cooperate with the New Jersey authorities.
Wow.
The Bureau of Investigation, later called the FBI, was authorized to investigate the case, while the U.S. Coast Guard, U.S. Customs Service, U.S. Immigration Service, and the Washington, D.C. police were told their services might be required. And they believed that the kidnappers might have been German, and that might have been why the letter had so many errors, that English was not their first language.
I was going to ask, isn't Charles Lindbergh a Nazi? Like, wasn't he a Nazi or a Nazi sympathizer? I think he was. I read that somewhere. Maybe.
It didn't come up in my research, so.
I'm going to dig, and I think that might be. There's something weird with him.
Yeah. So, New Jersey officials announced a $25,000 reward for the safe return of the baby. The Lindbergh family offered an additional $50,000 reward of their own. And at this time, the total reward of U.S. $75,000, which is equivalent to about $1.3 million today, was a tremendous sum of money because it's 1932.
Yeah.
They're in the midst of the Great Depression.
Yeah. Jeez.
$1.3 million in our money.
That's insane.
On March 6th, not quite a week after the kidnapping, a new ransom letter arrived by mail at the Lindbergh home.
Mm-hmm.
The letter was postmarked March 4th in Brooklyn, and it carried the same perforated red and blue marks.
Hmm.
The ransom had been raised to $70,000.
But they had 75, right?
Which they're offering 75 anyway to people with information.
Ah, I see.
So, a third ransom note, postmarked from Brooklyn, and also including the secret marks, arrived at the Lindbergh's attorney's mailbox on March 8th, informing that an intermediary appointed by the Lindberghs would not be accepted, and they requested a note in the newspaper, like he didn't want to work with somebody that they appointed.
Gotcha.
On the same date, Dr. John F. Condon of Bronx, New York, a retired school principal, published in the Bronx Home News an offer to act as a go-between and to pay an additional $1,000 ransom. The following day, the fourth ransom note was received by Dr. Condon, which indicated he would be acceptable as a go-between by the kidnapper, and then Lindbergh approved it.
Who?
I don't know.
There's another case where it does that, where it's like, I would like to offer my services as intermediary. Like, what?
Yeah.
And it was like a journalist or something, maybe. And it's like, what gives you the qualifications to act as a negotiator?
I know.
I mean, you were a school principal, but come on.
Yeah. About March 10th, 1932, Dr. Condon received $70,000 in cash as ransom and immediately started negotiations for payment through newspaper columns because, you know, you can't, like, text people or call. All through the newspaper.
That's right.
Using the code name JAFSIE.
JAFSIE?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
JAFSIE.
Okay.
About 8:30 p.m. on March 12th, after receiving an anonymous telephone call, Dr. Condon received the fifth ransom note delivered by Joseph Perrone, a taxicab driver who received it from an unidentified stranger. The message stated that another note would be found beneath a stone at a vacant stand 100 feet from an outlying subway station.
Are we on a scavenger hunt now or something?
Yeah, okay. for notes. Okay. This note, the sixth, was found by Condon as indicated. Following instructions therein, the doctor met an unidentified man who called himself John at Woodlawn Cemetery. They discussed payment of the ransom money. The stranger agreed to produce a token to prove he had possession of the baby.
Okay.
A baby's sleeping suit as a token of identity and a seventh ransom note were received by Dr. Condon on March 16th. The suit was delivered to the Lindberghs and later identified as belonging to baby Charlie.
Okay.
Condon continued his advertisements. The eighth ransom note was received by Condon on March 21st, insisting on complete compliance and advising that the kidnapping had been planned for a year.
Well, with all these notes, it takes time to write them.
And he's not done. There are more.
Oh, jeez.
Shortly thereafter, I jumped.
excited.
On March 29th, Betty Gow, the Lindbergh nurse, found the infant's thumb guard. It's like a...
Oh, I thought you were going to say thumb.
No, thumb guard. It's like a thing that goes over his thumb and it wraps around his wrist so he's not sucking on his thumb.
Like hand
sale? She found the thumb guard and he had been wearing it at the time of the kidnapping, okay. And it was near the entrance to their house.
Oh, wow.
The following day, the ninth ransom note was received by Condon, threatening to increase the demand to $100,000 and refusing a code for use in the newspaper column. So he was kind of getting agitated with the back and forth, and like they're trying to say, oh, we're going to kind of keep control of this. And he's mm-hmm. like, no, no.
Yeah, I'm getting agitated too.
Yeah. The 10th ransom note was issued on April 1st, 1932, and instructed him to have the money ready the following night. To which Condon replied by ad in the press. The 11th ransom note was delivered the next day by an unidentified taxi driver who said he received it from an unknown man. Dr. Condon found the 12th ransom note under a stone in front of a greenhouse in the Bronx as instructed in the 11th note.
This is worse than The Amazing Race.
This is so bad because there's not $1 million at the end of
this. No, this is a baby.
Shortly thereafter, on the same evening, following the instructions contained in the 12th note, Condon again met who he believed to be John to reduce the demand to $50,000. This amount was handed to the stranger in exchange for a receipt.
Oh, jeez.
And the 13th note containing instructions to the effect that the kidnapped child could be found on a boat named Nellie near Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts.
This is far too many notes for my taste.
Uh-huh. They're done. That was it.
Okay.
The stranger then walked north into the park woods and disappeared. The following day, an unsuccessful search for the baby was made near Martha's Vineyard. The search was later repeated. Dr. Condon was positive that he would recognize John if he ever saw him again. On May 12, 1932, a delivery truck driver pulled off the road near Mount Rose, New Jersey, for, about 4.5 miles from the Lindbergh home for a bathroom break, and he stumbled upon the body of a baby in the woods. The body was partially buried and badly decomposed. The baby's head was crushed and there was a hole in the skull and parts of the body were missing. He was found in the woods, so animals probably got to the body.
Yeah.
The body was positively identified as Charlie Lindbergh, and the coroner's examination showed that the child had been dead for about 2 months, and that's about how long he'd been missing.
So pretty immediately.
The death was caused by a blow to the head that either happened in the abduction or shortly after.
Oh.
So he was dead within 24 hours of being kidnapped.
Oh, that's horrible.
Which, if you watch Criminal Minds and they get involved in a case with a kid, they always say that those first 24 hours, after 24 hours, the odds of finding that child alive go down drastically.
Right.
The U.S. Bureau of Investigation had, until the discovery of the body, been acting in a purely advisory capacity. Mm-hmm. On May 13th, however, President Hoover authorized the Bureau to serve as the primary federal agency on the case, mm-hmm. and full resources of the U.S. Department of Justice were committed to the investigation of the crime. Public outrage led the U.S. Congress to pass the Federal Kidnapping Act, known as the Lindbergh Law, on June 22nd, 1932, the day that Charlie would have turned two. The Lindbergh Law made kidnapping across state lines a federal crime and stipulated that such an offense could be punished by death.
Yeah, that kind of comes into my story, too, because the FBI was able to get involved, I think, whenever he took him to Chicago because they were in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. He was kidnapped from New York, and they found him in Jersey. So technically he did cross state lines, even if it was just that little bit of, like, it was like a 5 mile.
Still, yeah.
Yeah. In June of 1932, officials began to suspect that the crime was an inside job that was perpetrated by someone the Lindberghs knew and trusted.
Mm-hmm.
A few leads were followed but led to no new information, though I think it was a maid that they questioned. She, after being questioned multiple times, she committed suicide by cyanide.
Ay, ay, ay. That's
so
not
whether,
an easy way to go.
Whether that was like guilt-related or just the stress of being constantly asked or whatever, but she committed suicide. Jeez. And then they actually looked at Condon, who was their go-between, a couple of times.
Yeah, I would.
To say, like, hey, maybe it was you. No new information came up. Investigators who were working on the case were soon at a standstill.
Mm-hmm.
There were no new developments and little evidence of any sort, so police turned their attention to tracking the ransom payments.
Mm-hmm.
So the following events would prove crucial in search for Charlie's killer. First, in 1933, as a result of the Depression, an executive order was enacted stating that all gold certificates be returned to the Treasury. It so happened that about 40,000 of the Lindbergh ransom money was in the form of these certificates.
Okay.
It was speculated before the ransom delivery that anyone in possession of that amount of gold certificates would draw attention to themselves. After the enactment of the executive order, this would prove especially true.
Mm-hmm.
Second, the serial numbers of the banknotes had been meticulously recorded prior to the handoff.
Mm-hmm.
During the manhunt, all New York City branch offices were given pamphlets containing the serial numbers of the Lindbergh ransom notes and advised to be on high alert for any matches.
Okay, smart.
Investigators got their big break when a New York bank alerted the New York Bureau office to report the discovery of a $10 gold certificate. The certificate was tracked back to a gas station. A filling attendant had received the certificate from a man whose description was strikingly similar to that of others of a man passing Lindbergh notes in recent weeks.
Okay.
The attendant, finding the $10 gold certificate suspicious, wrote the man's license plate number on the bill.
Smart.
This led the police to Richard Hauptmann, a German-born carpenter. Okay. A search of Hauptmann's home uncovered 14,000 of the Lindbergh ransom money, wood identical to that used to make the makeshift ladder, John Condon's phone number, and there were handwriting samples they found.
Whoa.
He was arrested on September 19, 1934.
Yeah.
Hauptmann was indicted in the Supreme Court, Bronx County, New York, on charges of extortion on September 26, 1934, and on October 8, 1934, in New Jersey, he was indicted for murder.
Okay.
2 days later, the governor of the state of New York honored the requisition of the governor of the state of New Jersey for the surrender of Hauptmann, and on October 19, 1934, he was removed from Hunterdon County Jail to await trial, so he was moved to New York.
Okay, got it.
The trial of Hauptmann began on January 3rd and lasted 5 weeks. The case against him was based on circumstantial evidence. Tool marks on the ladder matched tools owned by Hauptmann, which at that time, how many variations of tools could you find?
Right.
Like, really?
Yeah.
The wood in the ladder was found to match wood used as flooring in his attic.
Okay.
Again.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure a bunch of people had the same type of wood.
Yeah.
Dr. Condon's telephone number and address were found scrawled on a door frame inside of a closet. That's kind of suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
Handwriting on the ransom notes matched samples of Hauptmann's handwriting.
Okay.
He was convicted and immediately sentenced to death.
Whoa.
Despite many appeals, he was electrocuted on April 3rd, 1936, Whoa. Just over 4 years after the kidnapping.
Whoa.
Following his death, some reporters and independent investigators came up with numerous questions regarding the way the investigation was run and the fairness of the trial.
Mm-hmm.
Questions were raised concerning issues ranging from witness tampering to planting of evidence. Twice during the 1980s, Anna Hauptmann sued the state of New Jersey for unjust execution of her husband.
Mm-hmm.
Both times, the suits were dismissed on unknown grounds.
Jeez.
She continued fighting to clear his name until her death at age 95 in 1994.
Wow.
So, taking a page from your book,
okay.
There are a number of theories that come up about this case.
Okay, tell me.
Questions were raised and left doubts in people's minds, and we all know doubts can lead to some wild theories about what actually happened.
Yep.
One reason people still question the decisions made in this case is the fact that up until he was electrocuted, Hauptmann professed his innocence. Like, his story never changed.
Really?
He was very adamant that he had not done it.
Okay. Yeah, that's crazy. Usually, like, they'll confess.
Nope.
At some point, you
never changed it.
Wow.
Never wavered.
Okay.
Some people do believe that he was involved, but they believe that he didn't act alone. They believe that the crime couldn't have been carried out by just one person.
No.
The kidnapping, the ransom negotiations, the disposal of the body, multiple jobs that seemed to be too much for one person. Also, the fact that they found $15,000 in his garage. That's only about a third of the ransom demands. Where else did that money get split?
Yeah.
Where else did it go? It had to have been split between multiple parties.
Yeah,
at least
definitely,
three.
I definitely think he was involved, but I don't buy that he was the only person.
Another theory was that Colonel Lindbergh was involved in his own son's death. Although the child's health and physical condition at the time of his abduction were downplayed, even hidden from a curious public and law enforcement by Lindbergh and the boy's doctor, he appears to have been afflicted with a rickets-like condition that affected the development of strong bones. Mm-hmm. He required doses of vitamin D and daily exposure to a sun lamp kept cribside. He also had an issue with his foot, a two large cranium, and unfused skull bones.
Okay.
Moreover, the famous father took personal charge of many aspects of the investigation. It was a lot of his friends that were involved.
That's not okay.
He isolated household staff who may have had knowledge of his son's medical conditions from questioning by authorities, including J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. Like, he kept them out of their... like, off their radar.
That's sketchy.
Also, following a cursory autopsy, he ordered the body cremated and the ashes scattered. On March 1st, 1932, the date of the kidnapping, he also inadvertently missed a public speaking engagement for the first time ever.
Okay. Wait, the day of the kidnapping, he missed it. Okay.
He came home from New York City where he worked instead of going to a dinner where he was to speak. So was it merely a coincidence, or did he choose to facilitate the kidnapping, maybe by diverting attention away from the boy's second floor bedroom? Or was he like a lookout for the abductors so they could escape down like a back staircase? So he was supposed to be giving a speech like in town and he was home and he had never done that before.
Okay.
So.
Sketchy.
Supposedly I was looking at PBS did a special on it and it's not, you'd have to purchase it on iTunes. It's not free anywhere. But they're reopening that case. Ooh. Everybody involved's dead as of 2001, which was when the mom, Anna Lindbergh, died.
Okay.
But just something's not adding up.
Yeah.
So I think they're going to reopen it and try. They still have DNA samples. They still have, like, and with the forensics that we have today, they're going to try and see what they can find out about this. I mean, if we can figure out who Jack the Ripper is, we should be able to figure out what actually happened to Charles.
Yeah. So. We may have to, next time you're in town or I'm in town, we may have to pool our funds together and rent that to see. That's interesting.
Oh, yeah, not pool our funds. I think it's like $2, but you know.
Well, we can pool our funds. You give a dollar, I'll give a dollar. Well, that was great. I'm so glad you went that route because I've heard of it, obviously, but I've never, I didn't know all the details and stuff, and I never took the time to research it. So that was awesome.
Well, and then I'm like listening to it. I'm like, and my thoughts immediately go to American Horror Story. And as of, you know, 10 o'clock this morning, I hadn't seen Murder on the Orient Express and I hadn't read it. I read one of her other Hercule Poirot novels, but it wasn't this one. And I'm telling Elise kind of like the general facts of the case. She goes, "That sounds like Murder on the Orient Express." I'm like, "What?" She's like, "Yeah, you need to rent it and watch it." So I went on Redbox on demand, and sure enough, yep.
I was wondering,
but it was it was a little girl, and their names were Armstrong instead. But it was an American aviator and his wife, and the child went missing, and they found her dead in the woods, and all of that kind of stuff.
Wow. Okay. Spoiler, but I was wondering why when you took that picture. First, I was trying to see what your title was, and then I was like,
I know, I purposely like focused on the screen and not the laptop.
Yes. And then it had Murder on the Orient Express, and I was like, ah, she's just putting it on to have something to watch while she's working. I didn't realize you were doing research while you were doing it. Well, good job, that was awesome.
It was a lot of nonsense, a lot of ransom notes, third ransom notes, 13th ransom notes.
I mean, it's not funny, and it wasn't awesome, but you did a good job telling the story. And I think it's one of those that a lot of people take for granted, because it's like, oh yeah, Lindbergh baby, but you know, a lot of people.
And now you know, and it's the reason why the FBI can get involved in kidnapping cases like that. Yep. It's the Lindbergh law, that's what it is.
That's why they were involved with mine. Yep. So, good job. Oh man. Well, there you go. Kidnappings.
Yep.
Our episodes are getting long, and neither one of us like to waste your time. Not waste time. That's not the right word. Neither one of us like to take up too much of your time. Would be a better way of putting it. So we're just going to hoard our stories like little squirrels with little nuts, and we're going to stow them in a tree, and then we're going to give you like an episode on all the stuff you guys are sending us, because we're getting stuff. It's just some of it is we have to do our own research on it, and we're both a little busy right now, but soon maybe we'll have a little more time, we can do research, and we'll compile all of that into a little mashup episode for you guys. So
that works.
That works for you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. And we hope it works for you guys, because we'd like to have, you know, 5 or 6 different stories, probably 6 or 8, so that we're even. And, you know, have you guys talk to us instead of us talk at you. So send us your stories, send us your hauntings, your cautionary tales. Please send us urban legends. We're super excited. I promise you it's on the list. Our list is very long, but we're going to do urban legends. So email us your stories to itshereditarypod@gmail.com. Rate and review us on iTunes. It helps a lot. Thank you so much to everyone who has reviewed. We really, really appreciate it. Subscribe on Spotify, Google Play, iHeartRadio, iTunes. We're in lots of places doing lots of things. So.
Yep. We've been almost too much, like posting too much on Facebook and Instagram, but how else are we going to get our message out there? So follow us on Instagram, it's Hereditary Pod, Twitter, Hereditary Pod, follow us on Facebook. Yeah, we post funny things. We post pictures that have to relate to our stories every mm-hmm. Tuesday when we drop an episode. We share the episodes.
And we appreciate
put videos all the... of our dogs, you
yes,
know.
Yes. We appreciate all the commenting and stuff. We try to get to everyone, like everyone's stuff. So thanks everyone for getting involved.
Yeah.
Do you know what next episode is?
I do. Because I was gonna start researching, but I'm like, no, I don't want to get in that mindset just yet.
I'm in the mindset.
I was like, I'm gonna wait until we're done with recording this one mm-hmm. to then get into the Bloody Royals.
Heads will roll. Yes, we're gonna research some of those monsters, tyrants of history, and give you some information on it. So it's gonna be awesome. I might even whip out my Game of Thrones goblet. It might be that kind of royal night. I've got a chalice.
I mean, we might have to, yeah.
I'm definitely
we have Game of Thrones on right now anyway. Rip.
So.
Until we get our spinoffs.
Yep. So, well, I'm cooking red beans and it smells like they're burning. So, with that.
Oh, yeah, that's not good.
Good night, you hooligans. Sweet dreams. I think I stole your line.
Night.